part of the show is Talk is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks. Independent community radio, also streaming online at kpw.org. So today, continuing on with the Black Panther stuff and Curtis Austin, U of O professor, he did an interview, or he did a panel that featured Danny Glover and Kathleen Cleaver, who I believe was Eldridge Cleaver's wife. Anyway, I'm looking that up. So, yeah, so Danny Glover, the actor, talking about he was also an activist in the 60s. So he's going to talk about the importance of college campuses and resistance. The role of protest in transforming education with Danny Glover and Kathleen Cleaver coming up here. On KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio, also streaming at kpw.org. Don't forget, Wednesday the 4th here in Eugene at McNeil Riley House is they're going to be doing Angela Davis, Angela and Free Angela and All Political Prisoners. It's a movie about Angela Davis's struggle with the powers that be during the Vietnam War. That's here. 7 o'clock, McNeil Riley House here in Eugene, Oregon. 13th and Jefferson, Friday or Wednesday, February 5th. All right, stay tuned for Kathleen Cleaver and Danny Glover on the role of protest in transforming education. Recorded in October of 2018.
But all that aside, you know, often we kind of look at our lives and we attempt to try to grab some, have some sense about all the things that have happened. And as we often use the euphemism, trying to connect the dots. With, first of all, my own life. You know, I was born in 1946, the year after the end of World War II. My parents were postal employees. They came to the post office in 1948 as an expansion of the federal workspace and also the expansionism that was about to take place in this country as well. And certainly the change and the discourse around struggle. I mean, with Brown versus Board of Education, when I was 8 years old, Brown versus Board of Education had overturned Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896, almost 60 years after. And there was a new sense of movement and action that was taking place in that generation. Now, that does not decept to not include the activism of the 20th century, which is the first part of the 20th century was a radical moment with the great leaders, great African Americans, Du Bois, Robeson, and you had Eugene Debs, who ran for president from prison in 1918. On charges in prison, Emma Goldman. You can list the name of extraordinary men and women who were activists at the point in time. So I always like to think of ourselves in all movements, this continuum of movements that have been for. So the fact that we were out of San Francisco State in 1967, 66, and 67, where we were able to take over, essentially take over the campus at that particular point. It was a small group of African-American students, but they were organizers. Some of those students had come out of the struggles in Mississippi and Alabama, had come out of those struggles, had been a part of SNCC, part of CORE. And they had come back to school. We may remember Mario Savio, who began the free speech movement in Cal Berkeley as well. So if we kind of lay the context of understanding what was happening, and certainly without a doubt, the emergence of the Black Panther Party in Oakland impact all of the actions that took place, I think, around us, the students, whether we had Cal, whether we had whether we had San Francisco State, or wherever we were, had an enormous impact. Even high school students at Poly High School in San Francisco. So there's a sense of what was these things that are happening at this particular moment, but connecting those moments to what had happened in the past. Now, particularly what was happening in San Francisco was the beginning of the gentrification called redevelopment of the traditional Black community, the Fillmore. And what you realize, and what we found, that because of the situation of students, and the students came from these areas, they came from Oakland, San Francisco, you didn't come from often across the country. You came from Oakland, you came from San Francisco, you were local, so you were connected to a student. You came from the Mission, Hispanic, you came from the Chinese community, Asian community, all that was very important. So you had some sort of leverage and contact within the community itself. San Francisco State traditionally was a teacher's college, so there were something like 10 to 12 tutorial programs in various spots within the city. I think the Black Student Union realized that was a moment where we can mobilize people. We can engage not only in the work around educating or children or tutoring children, but we can also extend ourselves to beginning to be involved in the Western Addition Community Organization, WACO, which was an organization formed spontaneously out of members of the Western Addition who found themselves disempowered because of the things that were done with HUD and were doing with the Redevelopment Agency. So all this, the groundwork that happened and was happening at that point in time. We invited Amiri Baraka out to San Francisco State in the spring of 1967 as a part of what he called a community communication project, and using art as a form of engaging community and also able to find different ways of expression. Amiri was the leading, the leading voice around the Black Arts Movement at the particular point in time.
Don't do that, Sonia.
Huh?
Sonia Sanchez.
And Sonia said, Mrs. Sonia. Sonia was out there. I first heard Sonia Sanchez read poetry in a little place we call a little room that we had in 1966, in the summer of 1966. So that's the ground framework. We also were internationalists, I believe. And a great deal of that came from a number of different sources. Historically, African Americans have been internationalists as well. We responded to often the struggles that were going on in those former colonies, which had received their independence. Ghana in 1957, Nigeria in 1960, and such and such and such. Also, those colonies who were fighting against Portuguese oppression and trying to receive independence as well. So all these were the climates that were happening, not only the internal politics on campus, but also the external politics in our communities and external politics in other communities. You also had the organizing of the United Farm Workers by Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta. Organizing. All those are the things that were happening at the moment. So there were movements that were happening that I'd like to think of our movement as that sense, an extension of that, or something that complemented that.
Okay, thank you very much. That's a lot. And I say it's a lot because that force of history, things going on in the neighborhood, things going on that campus, things at Berkeley, Palo Alto, across the country, it sounds like what you're saying is it was kind of like it is today.
Oh, no.
Much more exciting. Well, let's see what you have to say about that.
It was much more exciting because people were dying. The Vietnam War was at its height. People were protesting the war. People were going to the war. Oakland was where they had trains going through the San Francisco Bay Area into Oakland to take troops and to take materials to the boats in San Diego so they could be shipped to Vietnam. And people would land down on the tracks trying to stop the delivery of war material. There was a huge anti-war protest. There was a huge mobilization of what we would call black students. This whole idea of black students was new. San Francisco State, I don't know when the black population in San Francisco State blew up, because I came from the West East Coast. I came from SNCC in Atlanta, Georgia, in the South, and came out to San Francisco, and I'd never been to that kind of environment, and I had met Eldridge Cleaver, who was a secret member of the Black Panther Party. Why was it a secret? Because he just got out of prison. He was on parole for having been in prison for, I think, 10 years, and he was a member of the Black Panther Party, which was an armed organization, and he was not allowed to carry weapons. He was an information minister. A group of them went up to the state capitol to protest a new law, the Mulford Act, that was going to disarm the Black Panthers, because anybody could carry the gun laws in San Francisco and the Bay Area were, California gun laws were fish and game laws. That's it. They didn't have any urban control over weapons. And so when the Black Panthers started patrolling the police and carrying weapons and openly demonstrating in front of the courthouse carrying rifles and shotguns, they decided to change the law. And when the negotiation and the debate in the California State Legislature was taking place on the Mulford Act, which was to change the gun laws, the Black Panthers sent a delegation to Sacramento, included Bobby Seale and a group of other Black Panthers. And Bobby Seale and the Panthers had never been to Sacramento. They'd never been to the state capitol. They wanted to know how could they go to observe the deliberations in the state capitol on the Mulford Act, and the press that saw these 12 or 13 Black Panthers in leather jackets carrying weapons, wearing berets, what they didn't know, the Panthers didn't know, is that there was more Panthers than Capitol Police. There was like about 5 or 6 police in the Capitol, and there was 12 or 13 Panthers, and so they just didn't show up. And they walked right into, they said, well, where do we go to observe? They wanted to go to the observer gallery. But the press was so stunned to see these young black men and women in leather jackets carrying weapons openly that they said, right there, and pointed them onto the floor of the state legislature where they walk right in, where the legislature was in the process of debating this bill. And then they see these Panthers walking in with guns, and they start ducking under their table and hiding, and it was pandemonium. So it hit the papers. It hit the papers all over the world. The person that I was involved with, who was named Eldridge Cleaver, was an ex-convict. He had absolutely no business carrying weapons. It was illegal. And he was arrested along with the rest of them. His lawyer came up and said, we have photographs. He was carrying a camera. He wasn't carrying a gun. Because otherwise, this parole would have been revoked, and it never would have met him, and it never would have gone to Algeria, never would have had 2 kids. But anyway, so it was a very, upbeat, exciting time. And California is different. I came from Alabama. I came from Georgia. I came from the South. It's different in that it seems to never get cold. So you can be outside all the time. And the Panthers were outside all the time. You didn't need warm clothes. So leather jackets, berets, guns. We weren't trying to make a fashion statement, as far as I knew, although the Panthers didn't want to look attractive, but it became a hit. And also California, in my opinion, being from Alabama, which is a very, very, very different type of society. I said to David Hilliard, who was one of the Panther leaders at the time, I said, David, you know down in Alabama, we could not be marching around the courthouse carrying weapons. That just wouldn't happen. California, the only laws were fish and game laws. So it didn't. Then they saw us. They wanted to change the laws. But the climate, the political climate, the San Francisco Bay Area, the labor organizing, all the organizing that had happened in that area before the Panthers even started, and then the combination of the Vietnam War, the people who are being drafted, the people who are coming back, and the young black students in college who had just come to the awareness of black consciousness and black power, particularly in Merritt College in Oakland and San Francisco State in San Francisco. Danny was at San Francisco State. Bobby Seale had been at Merritt College. I had dropped out of a couple of colleges before I came to California and did not go to school the whole time I was there. I was in the Black Panther Party the whole time. And it was a very exciting, uplifting moment because you're at the beginning of something. We didn't know how this was going to end. We didn't know what was going to happen in the Vietnam War, but we knew the whole country, mothers and parents and children and young men, were galvanized because of their opposition to the Vietnam War, which was very, very clearly being mobilized in California with the troop trains and the ships. And so the mobilization to support the war was based in the West Coast, and that the anti-war movement was very strong. So that's the context in which I came into the Black Panther Party in California. And having come out of Atlanta, Georgia, it was extraordinarily uplifting and exciting. I remember a conversation with David Hilliard. You couldn't do this in Alabama.
Let me make a point, just a short point. It was the Mississippi Democratic Freedom Party who attempted to unseat the Mississippi Democratic Party in 1964. That was on their platform was the denunciation of the Vietnam War, 1964.
Right, that was Fannie Lou Hamer up in
Chicago. Yeah, Fannie Lou Hamer, Bob Moses, Stokely, and all those who came out against the war in Vietnam.
Absolutely.
Before there was an anti-war movement.
Right.
It began.
That's right.
We tend to forget that. We often forget those people. And those men and women, Fannie Lou Hamer, have been fighting for the 3 years in Mississippi, being jailed, shot, beaten, and everything else, and killed, as we know, with Swerner, Goodman, and Cheney as well.
That's certainly a good point. And once again, it's that force of history that's pushing people to insist on being able to freely express themselves because they saw things that needed to be fixed. I want to get our other panelists involved here. And so my question for you is, why is it important to protect and defend freedom of speech and freedom of expression, particularly on college campuses? And I wonder if Leslie and Drew will take a stab at that.
Sure, I'll go first. So I want to bring up maybe I have a really clear example, which probably going to raise some hairs on the back of people's neck, but I'm going to do it anyways. So we had a white professor in the law department dress up in blackface, and lots of black students obviously were offended, right? And lots of black students wanted her to be fired. And those of us that were somewhat aware of what freedom of speech actually means were like, no, heck no. She's not going to be fired, because if they're going to fire a white woman with tenure, then what would that look like for any black professor with tenure? Like, that's freedom of speech means that you can say what you need to say, even if it is offensive, right? So one of the things that I think about when I think of, that's my example of how I feel about freedom of speech, right? But what I feel like is really the issue for blacks on this campus and their ability to speak freely is in our academic work. We are constantly being, tracked and told that we can't express ourselves through our academic work because we don't, meet, whatever standard it is. And it's not because we don't meet the standard, it's because we're trying to say something that nobody wants to hear. Because if I say what I want to say and you hear what I have to say, then it means that you have to change. It means that I don't fit in your box because your box no longer works. It never worked, but somehow it was able to be maintained. And so now there's black students on campus. There have always been black students on campus, as we see, who have always been trying to change something, say what it is that black people want to say, and there's always been some sort of censorship. And that comes in the form of academics, right? Like even on a university campus, there are academic strategies that keep people from being able to say what they need to say. And I'm speaking specifically about Black students, undergraduates, graduate students, and our Black professors. So when we take that back to a white woman not being able to express herself, and if we were to fire her, then no Black person on this campus is safe to express what they need to say.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, I think that deserves a hand, yes.
Definitely. I think for me it boils down to two things, and the first kind of connects to what Drew was just saying, which is that in a general sense, the whole cornerstone and foundation of American universities is predicated on intellectual freedom and academic freedom. That's what tenure is all about, and that's what the university system is all about, is that people should have the freedom and the right to express their academic and intellectual thought. And I think what really is sort of crucial to understanding that is that at the core of that is the idea that we actually can't all evolve and grow and learn and engage in critical thinking if we don't have the freedom to express ourselves. So in general terms, I think it's important for that reason. The other reason relates back to what I was talking about at the very beginning, which is that in the absence of freedom of speech and freedom of expression, and more specifically in the absence of student protest, we wouldn't all be sitting here right now. American education would look radically different right now. We would still be only teaching Western civilization. We would not have Black studies. We would not have queer studies. We would not have women's studies. We would not have ethnic studies. None of these academic disciplines that really now form the core of humanities at most universities across the country would not exist if it wasn't possible for people to express themselves and more specifically to protest when society or the university doesn't look like what they feel like it needs to look like. So in the absence of that, we would be, our universities would be very different and our lives would be very different.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much. So keeping up with that line of thinking, you want to respond to that?
I want to respond to this. It's very interesting how we look at the American university as we find out that Georgetown was able to save itself from going bankrupt because it sold slaves. Yes. It's very interesting how we look at it because it basically had been based upon based upon heritage. The whole idea of the university was to train the leaders from the beginning. It was not based upon, it had its connection with regular, ordinary people, regular population was certainly, they didn't speak on their behalf. So the university itself began only within the second half of the private schools. The early part of the 1930s, after the Depression, it began to be people with student shows on meritocracy. They're merit to go there. That's a new phenomenon, not the history part of a phenomenon within the context of American university from its institutionalization, because Harvard wasn't set up established to do that. Yale wasn't established to do that. All the places where you train those who succeed in sustaining the system itself, maintaining the system itself. You know, if it had been so, what we would want it to believe it is now, that maybe slavery would have ended sometime long before it did. But we know also that there are two stages of slavery. The right. Second part of slavery after 1800, when slavery made this country the richest country in the world. But within 40 years, the richest country economically in the world. So, but I'm saying we have, and when we frame that, so the idea of the strike of 1968, or the activities that students took on during that period, whether it's at Columbia, whether it's at Cornell, whether it was at Kent State, all those questions that they rose right there was met with some sort of violent response to that, as they were trying to change the nature of the university itself. You know, our motto was not unlike because of our relationship. We said we're going to take what we learn in the university and take that back to the community In fact, the Black Student Union had an off-campus office right around the corner for the Black Panther office in the Fillmore.
That might be why you caught so much hell.
So I think that, what'd you say?
So it might be why you caught so much hell.
But on the one hand, what I'm saying is that the framing this, and we'll go on, because I tried to provide some sort of the context that we come in. What Robeson said, each generation makes its own history and is judged by the history they make.
Well, that's a good point, because the question I want you and Kathleen to address about this making history is, could you just for a moment reflect on your role as a student activist during that period? What are some of your favorite memories? Now, I'm actually going to put you on the spot about 10 minutes from now, because you probably don't remember that. So I'm just warning you to figure out what could he possibly put me on the spot with. But and if you don't say that was one of your favorite memories, I'm going to ask you about it. But Kathleen, Danny, what were your favorite memories as a student activist?
Just say something. This is not favorite. This is, what do you call it, something I'll never forget. Not my favorite memory. We had an office in San Francisco for the Black Panther Party. The basic national office was in Oakland. Later on, there was offices in Los Angeles. There was offices here. But in San Francisco, the office was on Fillmore Street, and that's a particular type of black neighborhood. And that office was focused largely on political campaigns, because with the coalition that the Black Panther Party made with the Peace and Freedom Party, we had candidates for office. And I was a candidate for the state legislature. Bobby Seale was a candidate for state assembly. Huey Newton was a candidate for Congress. And Eldridge Cleaver, who was an ex-convict and was out on parole, was a candidate for president. Even though he was locked up in jail shortly after this candidacy because of his role in an incident that it was called the shootout with the Oakland police, in which one Panther was killed and three policemen were wounded, and Eldridge was wounded. But he still ran for president from prison.
I see. Yeah. So obviously don't need to be qualified to be president to be president.
He actually wasn't qualified because he wasn't old enough. He was not old enough. So Peggy Terry, who was the Peace and Freedom Party vice presidential candidate, was actually on the ballot. But if you vote for Peggy Terry, you're voting for Eldridge Cleaver. Anyway,
okay.
But the mobilization, because California was so insignificant to the Vietnam War, and also because San Francisco had a strong labor organizing tradition, and because there were so many recent influx of black students into the college scene in California, that it was all, and at the same time with the Vietnam War, so either you're being drafted or you're going to jail or you're doing this, so it was a very explosive and fruitful and a very, very exciting time in the country. And that's when I got there, and I didn't know much about California at all. I came out to worked with Eldridge Cleaver. He and I had met at a conference. He was on parole. The conference was in Nashville, and the conference was a liberation. It said liberation will come from a black thing. Well, but before the conference even got started, the police provoked a riot. And how did they do that? They set up some students to challenge a particular bus driver, and it ended up causing riots on the Fisk campus. And so here's an excuse to arrest people. It was a very volatile, exciting, upbeat time. And so it seemed that we could fundamentally challenge how people thought in the Bay Area. I don't know if that was the case. In fact, I know it was not the case in Georgia or Mississippi necessarily, or South Carolina, but it was very much the case on the West Coast, Seattle, San Francisco, California. And so the liveliness and the inventiveness and the imagination and the bravery put into the anti-war black power uprising was extraordinarily captivating. And it was also dangerous, but at that part I didn't spend any time thinking about.
Okay.
But you know, but really, I mean, I think for me, as a student, it was the climate, the way in which art was used in movement building.
Art.
And it was basically came out of the Free Southern Theater, which was connected to SNCC. and everything. And see, we don't invent this stuff. You know, like some people do it, everything up. And you see, you connect art and movement to real struggle with people who are being, finding where, or it came out of just the whole way of song in the civil rights movement. My company did a what we call Soundtrack to a Revolution. It was all the songs of the civil rights movement and everything. The way the song culture came out of it. But most other important was political study. That was the most thing that came out. We sit up all night discussing Marx. We sit up all night discussing Fanon. We sit up all night discussing Nkrumah, Nyerere, all those people. We were sit up talking about this all the time, talking about their thoughts and trying to find some way in which those thoughts are applicable to our situation. That was, I think, was very instructive. And as it says, made us to some degree internationalists as well. The same with the party. We'd have political education with the party. The Black Panther Party, the BSU members of the BSU. So I think those were the most exciting moments for me in terms of that right there, to kind of be introduced in the culture, and the culture through theater, culture through, and the role that theater and art plays in all the movement that we talk about, connecting those two. And I think that was a dangerous, dangerous kind of precept as well, you know,
yes.
A context. And certainly the Bay Area was rich of that, you know. I mean, I'm not even talking about the music that came out of the Bay Area at the same time. We know that all the music that came out of the Bay Area, San Francisco and the Bay Area at that same time. But the way in which we were able to connect those dots between art, culture, struggle.
In particular, San Francisco State, San Francisco's Black students went out on strike. That strike shut down the school. I think it was the longest student strike in history.
Yes, 5.5 months?
Yes.
5.5 months.
And the part of the reason is that the Black Student Union was fairly new that Black students were going to San Francisco State, and they had an organization, they had a union, and one of the members of the Black Panther Party, George Murray, was also a member of the Black Student Union, and he was also teaching at San Francisco State.
He was a teacher there.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. So this is the kind of people who are in this early movement of Black Panthers, Black Power, and anti-war that was bubbling in San Francisco, burning in San Francisco.
Sounds like a very, very exciting time.
Can I jump in here?
Sure.
I'm going to let you go. But the King himself talked about in 1968, in his speech, 67, beyond Vietnam, he talks about the axis between militarism, racism, and materialism. You know what I'm saying? So we were talking about the war in the sense, in a different way, in the context, and the other wars that were going on. I don't know if that is the same thing happening today. You know, I don't know if students are reflecting on that.
Less so. Drew, you had a comment?
Yeah, I wanted to jump in and say the idea of connecting the dots and staying up late talking, you know, with your friends on a university campus about what's going on and the type of climate that the Black Student Task Force came out of, for example. There was a moment where I feel like every day I was waking up and another Black man was being shot. And I think the moment that really, really struck home with me was the moment that Sandra Bland died, right, because she had a tail light out, right? And before then, it was like, you know, only Black men were the ones being harassed and so on and so on. But she was an academic. You know, she was in her car on her way home from a job interview at a university. And I was like, that could be me. And I think staying up late, you know, having the same kind of conversations, you know, you study this stuff and you study about the civil rights movement and you don't really know what you would do if you were in that moment, right? And I'm hearing now that, like, well, we were just doing it because it was exciting. We hadn't yet thought what the consequences were going to be. And I think the difference for us now is that we have seen what some of those consequences can be, right? And so when we talk about, you know, the protest, quote unquote, that the Black Student Task Force staged, I don't think that it's nearly the type of protest that we're talking about from the 1960s, right? Like, people gathered in front of Oregon Hall and then having a meeting with the president afterwards is not exactly the kind of protest that people were seeing. And I think you have to remember, too, that it had just come off of, you know, yet another shooting. I think it was Michael Brown right before. And everybody was more scared than they were excited, right? We were like, this kind of stuff needs to stop happening. But nobody wants to protest because we don't want to get shot. Are you kidding me? Like, who wants to get shot? We already know that they will do that to us. So to have a meeting is completely different than a protest, but it gets this, it's different and it's the same, right? The environment and the life that is on the line if you don't act is the same. And I think that's maybe what I'm hearing in terms of making a connection between the 60s movements on campus and the protests that we saw and the organization that we saw to what we see now. We have the benefit of looking back on history and saying the work has already been done. It's just a matter of us reminding everybody that people did this work already and we still need to continue to do the work. It's not us that's making this up. Like, this is a trend, this is a cycle, and it hasn't been completed yet. So let's pick this back up again. So to bring it home to the University of Oregon, at the same time that there are protests all over the world for Black studies and for ethnic studies and so on and so forth, we had our own Black student union that wrote their own grievances and complaints and had their own list of demands for the president of the university in 1968. You can Google it right now. You could say list of demands 1968 University of Oregon, and that document will pop up and you can read exactly what he was complaining about. And by him, I mean the president of the Black Student Union.
Okay. Thank you for that. And we've made a lot of comments about Black history, Black people, Black studies, but we are at the University of Oregon. And of course, it's not a Black school. But what I wanted to say about that is, if we actually read the history, study the history, examine what's in the record, what we find is at San Francisco State, at Wisconsin, at Cornell, at all of the major universities, Ohio State, when you look at these pictures, when you look at these documentaries, when you read the actual documents, you've got a whole bunch of white students there too. So it's not just a Black thing, it's certainly a Black thing, but you've got thousands, hundreds of thousands of white students across the country who are insisting on these same things. And so I'm making that point to ask my question. Right. Certainly, we want everybody to know who does not know that the reason these programs exist, these centers, these institutes, these departments exist, is because students, regardless of color, decided that they were going to right something they felt was wrong. And it didn't matter that they were not of a particular hue, a particular race, or particular ethnicity. And I want to make that clear. So my question is, what are some of the benefits and potential challenges that come with freedom of expression? Like, we have talked about the benefit a little bit, but what about the challenges? What are some of the challenges? Professor Alexander, I wonder if you could start with that.
Well, I mean, I think one of the obvious challenges is that when you open the door to freedom of expression, it means you have to listen to stuff you don't want to hear. That's the bottom line.
And Which is why I said the thing about the white protesters, because usually when I say that in my classes, my students, Black students, start throwing paper at me.
Right. I got some paper right here.
No, and I mean, Drew's example that she gave earlier, I think, is a perfect example. But I think that is at the core of it, the challenge, right? What do you do in an environment and in a situation where freedom of expression, regardless of your, you know, where you fall on the political spectrum, means that people with whom you disagree, right, have an equal right to express themselves, right? And that ultimately is the challenge, and it manifests from actually having to listen to dissenting opinions and things that you don't want to hear, all the way to, as we have seen at universities all across the country, all out, in some cases, in the case of UC Berkeley, right? And we were talking about this last night, Kathleen. You know, in the case of UC Berkeley, just last year, right, an all-out physical altercation, right, over the question of who is allowed to speak. And so the challenge becomes, how do we create an environment and create a society in which everyone has a right to express themselves, right, and that we find a way through critical debate, right, to hopefully move the society forward.
Okay. Thank you. Drew, would you like to come in on some of these challenges?
Sure, I'll try. I may ramble quite a bit, so I'm going to try to bring it back to... Ask me the question one more time before I get going. Yeah. I want to piggyback, but then I want to make sure
what,
I come
what
back.
Are some of the challenges that come with freedom of expression?
Right. So I disagree, and I'm going to look this way so that I'm like, you know, not having to make eye contact, but... I feel as though black labor is always exploited. And I feel as though black student protest is always exploited for the benefit of others that are not black. I feel like we advance what was not there, and white students benefit, and Latino students benefit, and Asian American students benefit, and all these non-black students will benefit from our labor. Our like fear, our us getting in trouble, us getting shot, for example, but yet now they have more scholarship opportunities, and black students don't necessarily have more scholarship opportunities, right? Like it's 2018 and we're still asking for the same stuff that everybody has that we've asked for since 1968. So in some ways I'm like, yeah, everybody has the freedom to protest, and everybody has the freedom of speech, but it seems that the black voice and the black freedom of expression and the black protest is always co-opted more. It benefits more the people of that are not black than it does benefit the people that are black. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, we put in more effort, but we reap less benefit, right? Like, we protest so that we can get into college, and then once we get into college, there's no professors there to help us, there's no money there to keep us there, but yet what white students benefit from our protest is now tuition is free for them. So now they get in, but when they get there, there's white professors, there's white money for them to stay there, there's support, they come from good schools, and we're barely getting in, but it was our labor that got them in there for free. So I don't agree, if I can not agree. And then I think that that's the challenge, right? Like you have to share everybody's ability to protest, but you may not necessarily reap the same benefit for the amount of work that you put in.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, I'm aware that neither of you, Kathleen and Danny, became a black studies professor, right? You went on and had great lives and great careers. And in the 19... Yeah, do you teach... That's true. That's true. Here's what I'm trying to get at. There were right around 25 million black people in the United States at the time. And at the time, this activism that you were involved in was going on. And what I've discovered through the documents is about 80,000 of those 25 million took part in the movement. So I'm not a mathematician, but I don't know, and I don't know what percentage of black people that is, but it's really small. And my question for you is, why was black studies important to you? Why were you one of those 80,000 people involved in this movement when the overwhelming majority, 98, 99% of black, well, maybe that's too high, not a mathematician, most black people were not involved. Why was that important to you?
Black studies. I was involved with the black power. It's a huge difference. We're talking about changing the world, getting people in office.
I can.
Self-defense, okay? That's what it was about. It's not about the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense was the organization that was created. It wasn't about being in school. In fact, it was about staying alive, okay, and not being shot, not being murdered, which is what was happening on a regular basis. The first issue of the Black Panther newspaper that I saw was a story about a young man in outside of Oakland. His name was Denzel Dowell. He had been shot by the police in, I can't think of the town. It wasn't Oakland. It was outside of Oakland.
Richmond?
Yeah, it was in Richmond. Denzel Dowell was about 17 or 16 years old, and he was running from the police for whatever they were chasing him for, not what he had done. He jumped over a fence and he shot him and killed him. He was a teenager. I mean, so he's a dead teenager. And his mother called different people, said, please come and help me. My son has been killed. He didn't do anything. He hadn't committed a crime. He didn't even have a record. Nobody came except the Panthers. They came and said, well, Ms. Dowell, we'll come and help you. And then when I came out to California, it was at that time that the Black Panther newspaper had just sort of become a folding paper. It was not just one. No, in fact, it wasn't. It was one sheet. The long paper that you put in a mimeograph or thing says, why was Denzel Dowell killed? This was the beginning of the Black Panther newspaper and the challenge publicly that the Black Panther organization was making to overt, unmitigated police brutality. And it went from there to, you know, many, many years, full-fledged 16-page newspapers, the Black Panther, I think the Black Panther Party lasted until the 70s.
In 1983.
Well, that wasn't much of a party. But
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, we can talk about that later. But well, you're absolutely right. It's about that, so it's, staying alive. It's about, and I get that.
But it's about what was happening on the ground to young Black people, young Black men, young parents, young families, and who was going to do something about it. And the young people in Oakland, they happened to have some expert leadership in the sense that Bobby Seale was not that young. He was a veteran. He was married. He'd been in the military. He was a contractor. So he had some skills. He had some talent and sense of responsibility. Some of the professors at San Francisco State or at other colleges who were a little bit older were in our corner. They supported us. So you saw a large number of Black women in mm-hmm. Oakland, particular Ruth Hagwood. I don't remember why, but she was sort of this very large, imposing community activist, and she took us, I think what it was, she took us under her wing. Well, I was too young to understand that's what it was going on. But so it was a community struggle. It looked like a youth movement, and it was a youth movement, but it was also a community struggle because the Black community in Oakland had been tormented for many, many years by police brutality, by bad housing, by bad education, but they hadn't stood up. And when the young Panthers started, yeah, we're gonna challenge this. We're gonna say you can't do it, and have demonstrations, and get in the news, and write banners. And it just sparked. So there was Latinos with us. There were Chinese with us. There's one of the posters. Not one of the photographs from the demonstrations. Two Chinese people in the group called Iwar Kun, and they have a big poster, and it's all in Chinese character. It says, you know, Chinese want power or something like that. So it was multinational, multi-ethnic, and also men and women together. So all that was very unusual for political mobilization for our community. And that
Thank
kind
you.
Of sparked
I,
a
I
lot.
I think that was important for Kathleen to make a differentiation between what was happening in terms of movement building. But it's consistent with the idea of transformation into Breakfast for Children, free schools, free health care, the kind of things that we still talk about now, and community control of police. There have been initiatives all over the country they're calling out police accountability. But those ideas around police accountability, police control, community control of police came through the Black Panther Party. And so they were able to mobilize people under those issues in the community. That's what they did. They were mobilizing people around the city. Now, to say that the Brown Berets and the other organizations that began to form themselves, it was, as J. Edgar Hoover said, the most dangerous, the Black Panther Party, the most dangerous thing to our national internal security, U.S. internal security. That's what he said about it. Because it was transformative in the sense, it wasn't on the campus. It didn't happen on the campus. It was transforming and taking young people and providing a level of meaningful moments in their life, texture, context within their life, historic context, as well as building another future as well. That's what the Black Panther Party is about. In fact, people talk about the Black Power Movement was about itself. The Black Power Movement is that in itself was another reimagination of democracy. That's what it was.
It's called Power to the People.
Power to the people. I mean, it's not a new slogan. You actually did that. And I think we have to understand that particular moment and what was happening in the country at the moment itself. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have internet. We didn't have all those things. People were organizing, going door to door, organized. They were talking to people. They knew what was happening with people in those communities.
I think that was that moment. I'm saying that doesn't have that can happen at this particular moment in the movement, in building a movement, but certain incidents on the movement. You know, things that happen on the movement and building the movement. How do you build a movement? You know, I think when I talked about the things that we learned as students from what was happening in our community, that was because we engaged in the community. We went to those Waco meetings. We listened to generational black, whites, Japanese who were affected by gentrification right there. We were at those meetings every weekend, every Monday night. We were at those meetings. We would assign students to go to and go to those meetings. We would report back what would happen at the meeting and how that we could be of service in the community itself. And that's the kind of process that I think that I said before was carried down. Students were snitched. Young people were doing this. This is the groundwork that was done.
Felt like you were part of something important, and it certainly was important. And I will not disagree with that. When it comes to the Black Panther Party and freedom of expression, I don't think there's any question around the impact of them. I'm sorry?
We brought Nathan Hare in the spring of 1960, in the fall of 1967 out of San Francisco State, specifically to design a Black Studies program.
Okay.
We've been talking about that Black Studies program. We brought him out there, and he spent a year in the development, meeting with students. Nathan Hare had been a product from, he came from Howard University, had been the leading voice in Black Studies in the country at that time. And so we brought him out there and began to talk with him about forming this. When we went to Summerskill, the president, for another year, he vacillated and refused. And part of the reason, as we got into November, we began to, that's when we went on strike. We went on strike. Part of that reason was why that happened that way because of that. Now, within that framework, what made the strike was successful was not simply the Black Student Union. It was progressive whites. It was teachers who came out in support. Teachers in San Jose State supported. Teachers on campus supported, and other teachers. It was the community who came out there as well, not only community, because we had engaged the Hispanic students had engaged their community and brought them out there. Asian students came out there. So the coalition itself was made it possible for us to achieve what we were able to achieve, you know. And it's in its 50th year. Next year celebrates the 50th year of the School of Ethnic Studies.
That's right.
It's the Black Students with School of Ethnic Studies.
That's right.
So on one hand, I think that was the kind of moment, I think historically a moment where we begin to digest what is happening around the world. All of us, we find that we build coalition. That's the one key about how do you build coalitions? You know?
Yeah.
How do you build coalition? And I think the strike would not have been successful had it not been for that coalition. Which community, each respective communities, and also with building the Third World Liberation Front. That's what it was, the Third World Liberation Front.
Also in the Bay Area, people would go to school together. For example, there'd be
Japanese students and black students in the same school because they lived in the same neighborhood in Oakland. That wouldn't necessarily be true in San Francisco, and there definitely wouldn't be true in a city like New York City. You know, Japanese people would live someplace other than where black people live. So the multi-ethnic, multicultural California Bay Area community, I think, did a lot to promote what we would call internationalism,
Third world,
and people knew each other. They went to high school together, which is unlike, I'd say, many other cities.
Okay,
but we had to have empathy for those other struggles as well.
Let me see if I can get us to talk about a point around freedom of expression, right? And this is going to kind of change. I hope it changes the discussion a little bit. And I'm just curious. And this is for any of the panelists. Can you imagine a situation where limiting freedom of expression would be desirable? I mean, you gave us the example of blackface, the blackface example. And a lot of us wouldn't want to see that, but that's that person's expressing themselves, right? I've taught at universities where people routinely use the N-word in their teaching. Well, this person has tenure, they're quoting a document. Okay, it offends a student, so why can't I say that? The question, can you imagine a situation where limiting freedom of expression would be desirable? And if so, can you give us an example of how that would work?
Wait a minute. Insult and hostility is not part of freedom of expression. That's something else.
Use your mic.
I'm sorry. I said insult and hostility is not part of freedom of expression. It's something else. It could be racial speech. It could be hate speech. But if you put it under the cloak of we have freedom of speech, then it's acceptable. So there has to be another way of conceptualizing what are we talking about.
Okay, good point. Good point. Any other commenters on my misdirected question?
No, I mean, I would just second the point that, you know, hate speech is not protected speech. You know, there's lots of situations in which freedom of speech is limited. And, of course, the classic example is you can't walk into a crowded theater and yell fire, right? And hate speech is a perfect example of speech that is not protected, and I don't see any reason why we ought to. So, yeah, I think that's a perfect example of, of, you know, how we there are certain circumstances under which we do need to limit.
It would be desirable.
Freedom of expression.
And that example, Drew, could you think of a time other than the blackface incident when freedom of expression would be desirable? Stopping freedom of expression.
No, I have the opposite opinion, which is what I expressed earlier, right? Like, okay. In my conceptualization, black people's freedom of speech is already limited. And it's not... Maybe we're not aware of it, right? Maybe we censor ourselves because we're afraid of whatever repercussions might be had that you need to face after you've said what you need to say. And I mean, I'm going to date myself and be like, I grew up in the 80s and I grew up with that conceptualization, right? My mom's a 60s kid and, you know, she always has all this advice about, you know, you don't go here and you don't do this and you don't say that and you never get yourself in any inappropriate situations. And the best protection for yourself is just to not be there. And so with that same ideology, the best protection for you is to not say anything. And that in and of itself is limiting my freedom of speech, right? So when I do speak up, and when I do, you know, get all my stuff together, all my faculties together so that I can say this thing that I need to say that nobody wants me to say, that nobody is ready to hear. You can't limit anyone from saying what they need to say because the systems that be will attempt to therefore limit my freedom of speech even more. So I, on the other hand, I'm willing to put up with quote unquote hate speech if it means that I always maintain my own ability to speak, because it's already hard enough for me to be able to do that. And so any limitations on the most protected classes of our society means more restriction on the least of us. And I'm already restricted enough. So you go ahead and you say whatever it is that you need to say, even if it's hateful, because at least I know where we stand. I would much rather know that you don't like me rather than you pretend to like me. And then I'm facing a whole other monster, right? Like, oh, yes, come on in. And then you get in there, and there's 15 guys ready to beat you up. I'm good. Just tell me you don't like me. I won't go over there.
Okay. Well, while I've got you on the microphone, I want to ask you something very specific, because in another 6 or 8 minutes, we'd like to have a couple of questions from the audience, and I want to get to that. But because we're at the University of Oregon, because we really want to address this issue to have an impact on the community and the students, I'm curious if you can answer this particular question, Drew. Why is there a need for an independent black...
Thank you. fucking doing, no man. Building deep in the system. He was a body remover. I'll give you a dose, but it can never come close to the rest. Builds up inside of me. Fist in the air in the land of hypocrisy. Movement's coming, movement's going. Need a speed movement, cease when the head gets blown. Cause all these fucks, they got bullets in their head. The prophets are police, the judges, the best. Then what's it worth? Keep your people calm. They don't even have to change when he spoke out of Vietnam. Turn the power to the have-nots, and they came to shop.
Thank you for listening to KEPWLP.
We're going to my mind, I'm flex, I'm slim, I'm roasted. Focus never lacking, that finesse. What do I got to, what do I got to do to wake you up? To break you up, to break the structure up. This blood still flows in the gutter. I'm not taking photos, the rest of the sun kicks open the shutter. Set the crew, and stick your mood like I was catch. Step is gonna step, Baba left them on the fascist. Seven defensive men who pulled schemes on the tree and put it to an end. You better beware of retribution with my war. 2020 vision fills with metaphors. Devils at work, keeping people calm. You know they murdered X and tried to blame it on Islam. They turned the power to the have-nots, and they came to shot.
Countries and profit from their reconstruction in order to survive. And that's not a system that changes every 4 years. It's a system that we have to break down generation after generation after generation after generation.
So bored.